You guys are doing well. Some good, really good conversations around the table, and folks I had a chance to chat with over coffee and grapes. Also very, very insightful. One young gentleman mentioned to me that he was open to sharing with some other couples, but most of the couples that he knew were non-Christian couples. So almost seeming to indicate non-Christian couples, so this stuff is not going to work. But forgetting one very, very key component, of course, is that the Bible is not addressed to Christians, it's addressed to people. Right? That distinction is huge. It's not addressed to Christians, it's addressed to people. So there's human issues. You have friends who don't know the Lord. You don't say to them, obviously your marriage is broken, I've got some ways to fix it. But you say, you seem to be having a pretty decent marriage, how would you like to make it even better? And hang out for three Saturday nights over pizza and whatever. And if three nights is too many, you can drop out. If you want more than three, I'm open to that. But even to invite one or two or five non-Christian couples that you know, because the Song of Solomon is addressed to people. It's addressed to people. It's not addressed to Christians only. And you can be very quick to admit that marriages inside the church need reminders and fixing almost as often as those outside. In fact, all the statistics indicate that marriages that fail as often inside the church as outside. It's very sad, but in the USA and Canada, that's true. Now, there's my clock. Almost 11. We're doing well. Charlie Shedd was, for quite some years, the United Methodist pastor on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia, pastor of a very, very large church. And as he was one Sunday morning, he was in his second floor office and pacing and praying and getting ready for the morning message. He happened to glance outside as the people were coming into his huge car park, the parking lot of the church. And as he just kept watching and watching and watching, something slowly began to click for him, and he said, "That is interesting. I need to check this up. I need to do a little investigation." So he gave it two more Sundays. He was there first thing, and his car was the only one in the car park. And he watched until the very last car came in. And over two Sundays, he said, "This is my conclusion." He said, "I saw a lot of cars pull in, and one door opened, and a male would come around the front or around the back and open the door, and a young lady got out on the other side. And also noticed a lot of cars in which two doors would open simultaneously, and a man would spill out, and a woman would spill out, and one, two, or 16 kids would come from the back seat of the van or the bus or whatever." But he said, "Sometimes one came, and sometimes two doors." And he said his observation was, without even one exception, that when the fella went around and opened the door for the young lady, it was either a special friend or a fiancé. When two doors opened, she was the wife and the mother. Without any exception. So that sets the stage, you see, for this section, which we call a courtship. And a marriage is an ongoing, continuing courtship. Marriage is an ongoing, continuing courtship. And why do courtship skills and habits and values so often end at marriage? And it's mainly the guy's problem. Sorry, guys. It's mainly the guy's problem because sitting deep inside of us, kind of woven into our genes, we're hunters. We're hunters, and we pursue the prize. Now, whether it's the trout in the stream with the latest lure, the latest fly, or a moose or something hiding in the woods, and finally we got that moose in our sights and bagged the moose during moose season. And when the prize has been trussed and cut apart into steaks and chops and all the rest, we go on to the next target. And that thinking, you see, carries over into marriage. Very often they say, "I do." A man says, "I have done it." Yeah, I do. I've done it. I've landed her. And if you look inside a man's soul, a lot of the hunting skills after the honeymoon are focused in the world of work and not the world of marriage. A lot of the hunting skills are focused in his work, how to get along with the boss, the higher-ups, as well as his colleagues to get that promotion, to get the raise, to get a corner office with a special bathroom and all the rest, or to be transferred to Calgary. Whatever it takes, the focus is on work. He's already landed the bride. No, it's not I do, but I'm done. I'm done. But to continue to win your wife for a lifetime, a continuing courtship, continue to win her. And as we said in the circle here, Kathy's lovely phrase, become a student of your husband, become a student of your wife, so that you can honestly say without darting eyes or cross fingers that I still expect after 50 years of marriage that I'll find out things about Kathy I never knew. And I'll do things and say things that have Kathy saying on the way home, hey, I never knew, and usually followed by, and I hope never again. But there's still the capacity to surprise each other after 50 years of marriage. So you continue to win the bride you've already won. So it's very easy to say when you get into the courtship section, oh, there might be some stuff to pass along to my son, who's 18, my daughter who's 13 and already bemoaning the fact that she's not going with anybody. It's great stuff for them. It's not for them, it's for you also, and it's for me. Okay, so.
Runaway grape.
Are you more clean?
Yeah, go ahead. How you feeling?
Grape expectations. So we start with chapter 1. And the outline is on the board. Courtship 1:1 to 3:5. And we've divided it, Kathy and I, into three sections. What are you looking for? 1:1 to 8. What are you aiming for? 1:9 to 2:7. Then what are you waiting for? 2:8 to 3:5. What are you looking for in a partner? And then once he or she has been identified as God's choice for you, what are you aiming for in the relationship? How's courtship supposed to develop the habits and the values and so on that will stand you in good stead for a lifetime? And then if it's all right, why isn't it all right right now? And then 2:8 to 3:5, a very interesting threefold study and why Christians have, I think, the best opportunity to have a lasting marriage, because Christians are the only people in the world who know how to wait. They're the only people in the world who know how to wait and know the wisdom of avoiding shortcuts. That's not a skill on the other side of the doors, but that skill is available to us. And they wait for three things before the wedding happens in 3:6. That's why they're going to develop a really great relationship. 1:1 to 1:8. Solomon's Song of Songs. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine, pleasing as the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. We rejoice, say the girls in the harem. We rejoice and delight in you, they say to the king. We will praise your love more than wine. And in an aside, she says, how right they are to adore you. Dark am I, she says to the girls. Dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. Dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I have neglected. Tell me who you whom I love, where you graze your flock, and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? If you do not know, most beautiful of women, follow the tracks of the sheep, and graze your young goats by the tents of the shepherds. 1:1-8. Not an easy section at all. Not easy. There's a lot of confusion, a variety of interpretations. Let me give you our take on it. Solomon's Song of Songs. Song of Songs is a very nice way of the Hebrew saying, this is the greatest, this number one on the hit parade. So God is not just another king, he's the King of Kings. Not only the Lord, he's the Lord of Lords. And he lives among us symbolically, not in the outer court or the holy place, but in the Holy of Holies. So this is the Hebrew way of speaking. We would say, for instance, John is handsome, and Peter is handsomer, and I'm handsomest, right? Or no, Phil is smart, and
Mario,
smarter? Smartest. No, that's just an example. But the Hebrew has no way of doing the what is called the normative, comparative, superlative. The superlative is King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Holy of Holies. So when Adam says, after the anesthesia had worn off, and he was presented with his partner, he says, God, you could not have done better than this. This is absolutely fantastic. I am so glad that I didn't get in the way, that I didn't peer over your shoulder and say, a bit more of this, a bit less of that. I'm so glad that I didn't get in the way, because she is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. See, the Hebrew way of saying she is the greatest. No way I could have done better myself. Bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. So this is Solomon's Song of Songs. Song of Songs, the number one on the hit parade. Probably written between 970 and 930 BC. Solomon, king of the largest empire the world has seen, certainly under the Jewish flag. He owned a lot of property all over the Middle East. My take on how the initial rendezvous happened, that's not in the text, by the way, but a very reasonable explanation on how this happened is that Solomon was at a banquet with a lot of his colleagues and friends from other countries, and the food was great, but the wine was really, really, really great. It is much better than the south of France, the Napa Valley, and the Cape Town area combined. This was great wine. So somebody said to him, Solomon, where'd you get that wine from? Where does that come? Which vineyard? So he called his sommelier. Are these people right? The wine tasters, the sommelier, called him over and says, where does that wine come from? So I'll get the answer for you, sir. 20 minutes later, he was back. Comes from the foothills of Mount Hermon in the country of Lebanon, just north. So Solomon decides to check it out. It's about 100 miles north. So as he liked to do, get away from the palace now and then, put the crown, the scepter, the toga in the cupboard, put on his blue jeans. Again, it's not in the text. But he put on his blue jeans, got on his horse, and he went to inspect the vineyards that he had loaned out to a woman whose husband had died, and her sons and youngest daughter were in the vineyards all day long working. So the husband had died. She was there with several sons and one youngest daughter. And as Solomon went to inspect the grapes, row by row by row by row, he noticed the young lady spark among the grapes. He said, what's your name? She told him. Had a conversation back and forth about the soil, about tending the vineyard, about the weather and all the rest. And Solomon looked at his watch. A 5-10 minute conversation. He'd been chatting with her for an hour. One conversation turned into another one. He spent a lot of time in that particular part of the vineyard, and then asked her to come to his home. She was shocked. The man with the blue jeans on the horse was actually the owner of the vineyard, and he was the king, owning most of the property in the Middle East that she knew. So she's absolutely overwhelmed, and the story will come along the lines, we won't play with this too much, but the story develops along the lines that is, to me, utterly fascinating, because it's the same story that God works out with his church. That's the shadows. That's the backdrop. And that is that she needs to learn how to be a lover and be comfortable with bedroom language, and to be a queen and to be comfortable with throne room language. The two worlds that she's asked to inhabit are the bedroom and the throne room. Learn bedroom language, throne room language. She welcomes the one, she's more and more comfortable and at ease with the one, but a theme that plays out underneath the whole Song of Solomon is that this queen stuff causes a lot of trouble. It's the world of calling, vocation, and work on his part that is very difficult for her. So she is attracted to the one and very troubled by the other. See, and if you take those double themes that run throughout the Song of Solomon and take it to the larger backdrop, if you will, the second message, not the first, but the second message, the church is both invited to crawl on Jesus' lap, snuggle up to him, and hear him whisper sweet somethings in her ear. This is my divine lover. But then as he whispers in that close Jericho road, in the garden with dew dripping from the roses, you know the song, the intimate one-on-one relationship, one thing that he whispers in our ear that we're not ready for, but we need to start being ready for, he says, you're special to me, I love you, and you know, someday, you and I, we're going to run the universe together. You're not 10 steps behind African style. African paths are designed for one, not for two. You're not 15 steps, but you're a sunergoi, a co-worker. You're by my side. You're my queen. You're going to judge angels someday, 1 Corinthians 3 and 6. You're going to run the universe with me. You're my bride, my queen. And we say the lover part, that's attractive. But getting ready to run the universe? I don't know. So the bride of Christ has the same tension that the bride, the young lassie from Lebanon, has in this story from almost 3,000 years ago. The parallels are wonderful. Okay. I'm going to talk to you about three sets of tensions from these first eight verses, and then one thing that'll wrap it up. So there's seven. I like the letter seven, number seven. So there's three sets of tensions, and that'll issue into a seventh that'll wrap up all the others from the first eight verses. Then we'll get Kathy up with... what are you aiming for? I love the fact, I hope you do too, I love the fact that the story does not start Solomon's Song of Songs, verse 1, and then verse 2, once upon a time in ancient Israel, once upon a time in ancient Israel, there was a king who, and then of course they live happily ever after, two or three or six pages later. It does not start like a fairy tale. It starts with, wait for it, in God's holy, inspired, inerrant word, you can add more adjectives, with the word yisakeni. And yisakeni is the Hebrew for kiss me. This song starts with kiss me, yisakeni, indicating that at the very center of the universe is someone with emotions. Someone who can laugh and cry and get angry. Someone who loves the attention, the embrace. Someone who can be stern and rebuke with the best, and yet who cries tears, real tears. At the center, God says, you're made in my image, so chemistry is important. You're made in my image, so chemistry is important. Yisakeni. So it's not just one among other friendships, but there's something special, something aha. That's what she starts with. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Notice she doesn't say, I'm going to plant a kiss on you that you'll remember for the rest of your life. She says, let him kiss me. The initiative is still his, but she expresses what's coming from her heart. The initiative is still his. Let him kiss me. Your love is more delightful than wine. I love the story, and I would take this to be quite normal, of the man who was married 50 years, and his best man was able to come to the occasion, and they stood before the microphone, and he said, my friend here has been so devoted to his wife for 50 years. The way he speaks about her, the way he looks at her across a crowded room, in fact, what I've done is I've checked with a medical colleague, and I've counted up that, I'll invent a number here, that every single heartbeat has been for her since they first met, and that's 1,500,293 heartbeats that he's beat for her. What a man. And finally, the husband got up and he said, I really appreciate the tribute. Thank you very much. One slight correction. Not 293. Actually, it was 292. Because when my wife and I met, my heart skipped a beat. My heart skipped a beat. So 2 years ago, Kerry was involved in the relationship, and he emailed me and said, Dad, the chemistry is just not there. So we knew it was all over. So in May, he said, I'm going to a wedding in Nova Scotia. I'm best man at my best friend's wedding. So I prayed. Doesn't happen very often. But I prayed, God, let him meet someone in the wedding party who's from Calgary, Alberta. Now, that's a prayer that is set up for disappointment, isn't it? Talk about leading with your chin. No, hit me again. No, wedding party, Calgary, Alberta. 1 week later, he emails us in Africa and said, Mom, Dad, I met someone at the wedding, and I need to tell you, I am smitten. She's cousin to the bridegroom, and her home is Fort McMurray, Alberta. So my prayers are like horseshoes. They're not dead ringers, but they're close. <You know?
laughs> Right? Leader's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. All right. She's from Alberta. And he's in Alberta right now for American Thanksgiving, and they're spending 10 days together just deepening the friendship, and they're reading Yancey's The Jesus I Never Knew together, you know, a chapter each, and then they chat about what they're learning. Recommended that and bought a book for each of them. They accepted it gladly, said, we're studying it right now. I'm in chapter 5, and so on. So that journey is continuing. I think we think he's on the journey to faith. She's one of those great Canadians who has never been faced with a fork in the road. Catholic history, but she's never faced the Jesus yes or no in 26 years of living in Alberta. So she's exploring this new territory called God and Jesus and faith and the difference that can make. So you might pray with us for that journey, but Carrie's quite smitten, as he says, and the pictures on the little screen that we get are also very encouraging. Carrie has his father's taste in women. That was a compliment.
We got it, too.
Yeah. After 14 months, hey. Still works. All right, let him kiss me. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. So something is right about saying that she's there with a second look. Wow. A second look that translates into 2, 15, 30, 50 years into a marriage where in one of my wonderful scenarios, you can be at a crowded party, a church social, 100 bodies milling around with coffee and goodies, and then she's at one end and he's at the other end, and they catch each other's eye, and she goes, they've got a lease on another year of marriage, at least, you know. They catch each other's eye, and he says, you know, that woman, she still turns me on. And that is right. That's how the Song of Solomon starts. Not, I'll find some way to endure this thing, but enjoyment. Enjoyment. But it's not enjoyment that is blind. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. Your name or your reputation is like perfume poured out. Her emotions are alive in 1-2. Her mind is alive in 1-3. The mind and the emotions are a pair, you see. Your name is like perfume poured out. And I like to say to couples that if the one that you're more seriously spending time with doesn't excite your parents and your youth pastor and your closest friends the same way that she does you, you need to have a second look. if others around you are seeing things that you're not seeing, or you're seeing things that nobody else is seeing, you need to at least wait and get more time. Now, your choice needs to be affirmed and endorsed by the community of folks who know you well. So operate with your grace cells intact. So, yeah, the chemistry's there. Let him kiss me with the kisses, but your name is like perfume. Your reputation, what others say about you, what others think about you, really counts. It really matters. Because marriage is a communal situation, not just two hand-in-hand wandering off into the nearest sunset. It's a communal something that needs an endorsement right from the start. So what we do is we don't go to Fort McMurray ever. So there have been three occasions so far that Carrie's sisters have had a chance to spend time with KK. That's Christy Kanakin. That's Carrie's special friend. And they've been on a houseboat adventure in the Okanagan. They spend a week, two of my girls, and my married daughter and her husband spent some time with her just a few weeks ago, and they say they're our official designated spies. Tell us about KK. And we get the news back in emails and phone calls that Carrie's really made a good choice, and what really stood out for them, here's a girl that really respects and likes our brother. She really respects and she likes our brother. So, see, we're engaging the larger community. It's not only emotions. Why doesn't anybody else see what I see in him? Not good enough. Okay? So the next pair is, you anticipate the affection, you admire his reputation. The second set is time alone and time together. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. Take me away with you. And then the same thing is there in 1:7, tell me you whom I love in 7, where you graze your flock, where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman, a prostitute, beside the flocks of your friends, pitching up after dark? I want to come at midday. Midday is safe time. And I want to see what you're like at work. And the shepherd king imagery is always interwoven for Israel's kings. David, the shepherd king, you know, set the tone. So the shepherd imagery comes up again and again as a symbol of a shepherd leads his sheep, a king leads his people. So she picks up on that, but says, in midday, I want to see what your work is like. And special friends or fiancés or wives who haven't a clue what the husband does from 9 to 5 every day. He's involved somehow in the IT and with computer software. That's all I know. I know where he works, but I don't know what he does there. He's off to some conference in Halifax or Ottawa, but all I know is it lasts 3 days, and he's called me every night, so I think it's okay. No, it's got to be more than that. At midday, let me see what your work is like and how it affects you, and hang out with your colleagues and see this a little bit. And again, the larger community, there's the flip side. I want to spend time alone with you to get to know what counts, what matters to you. But then no wonder the maidens love you. Their opinion is important, how right they are to adore you. So again, does your mother like the man that you've selected? Does your father like the girl that you're getting more serious about? Absolutely vital questions. So alone and together. And the third set that I see there, 1:5, dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. Dark, like the tents of Kedar. There's a combination in her, a very intriguing combination of being apprehensive or anxious. Dark am I. Very similar to what we used to call the colored people, or then the Negroes. They've gone through 4 stages, right? You know this? From colored people to Negroes to blacks to Afro-Americans. There's 4 stages, about a decade or 15 years each. And you tell where a person is in the whole rights thing in the United States by what term they use. Martin Luther King was the chair of the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. You would dare use that word today. But in the 50s and 60s, it made sense. Colored people. But the value was to have a light skin, like the whites, to have flat hair, so you can buy salve on the chemist shelves to flatten out your hair, because to be more white would be to be more successful, and to be less black or less me. So lighten the skin and flatten the hair. So what is the reaction to flat hair, white skin? Well, in the 70s, go back through your history, in the 70s, You get blacks saying, no, we're proud of being me. And you get the afros. Right? That's when the afros came in. So there's all these stages. And she says, these women of the court, all they have time for is pay attention to their appearance, salves and ointments and eyeliner and rouge and all the rest and light skin. And I'm dark, working morning till night under the sun. I have no time to pay attention to my own appearance. I'm just an odd duck. I don't really fit here. Dark am I, and she'll say later, my mother's sons were angry with me. They made me take care of the vineyards, my own vineyard. I have neglected. So there's a candor, there's an honesty there, not pretending to be someone she's not. Yet a wonderful comfort in her own skin, an assertiveness, if you like. Dark am I, yet lovely. Do not stare at me because I'm dark, because I'm darkened by the sun. So there's a combination. She's candid, she's honest, she's open about who she is, and yet there's also the not little old me, or I don't have any skills, or I don't know what in the world Solomon sees in me. She says, no, I have something to offer. I'm unique. And ladies of the court, there may be 300 or 1,000 of you, but I'm going to stand up for myself, gently, but do not stare at me. I am dark, but I'm lovely in my own way. So there's that wonderful combination of apprehensive and assertive. Okay? So there's those three mixes. The emotions and the mind come into play. She wants to spend time with him alone and in community. And then her own character comes on display as well. What are you looking for? Well, those seem to be three combinations that are important as they search out a lifetime mate. One thing that we've done, and before I get to the seventh one, let me just mention this. One thing that we've done again and again for groups, the last time was in Zambia last year when they gave us 35, 45 young people, all single, late teens, early 20s, and we'll say, what are you looking for in a lifetime partner? What are you looking for? The men make a list among themselves. The women make a list. We put all the stuff up in a flip chart or a board like this one. What are the men looking for? What are the women looking for? Women are very interested in what the men are looking for, of course, and vice versa. In Zambia, first time this ever happened, three men said, what's important to me is a woman with wide hips. No explanation. But for three men, that was very important. They have wide hips. And you come up with very strange things that appear on the board. But then we ask the next question, which always catches people off guard. Not, what are you looking for, men? What are you looking for, women? But what do you have to offer to a marital relationship? Who are you, and what do you have to offer as a future husband? What do you have to offer as a potential wife? See, there's the flip side. But the key that sits underneath all these eight verses is accepting the other. She accepts the king for who he is. He accepts her little vineyard gal from 100 miles north who's in his employ. It's a vineyard he rents out to a widow and her kids. And he accepts her. They accept each other, accepting. And the story that we really like, I'll close my part with this, is, let me see if I recall, Billy Graham's wife, Ruth Bell Graham, once spoke to the Lord, just very, very openly, very candidly. She said, Lord, outside the front door, Billy's a hero. He speaks, 3,000 people come to the front. He raises up his hand with the Bible. At the end, he says, literature, the way only Billy Graham can say that. And he sells literature. And people want, they come to a restaurant and they want him to sign their books. But inside the house, God, you know the man I live with. He raises his voice now and then. He loses his temper. Socks all over the bedroom floor. He doesn't put things away. Lord, please change him. And she said, as clearly as could be imagined, she heard the Lord's voice in her bedroom in North Carolina saying to her, Ruth, you and I need to get our assignment straight. Your assignment is to love Billy. My assignment is to change him. Okay, 1:9.
Okay, how you doing? Good. It's down a bit. So we're moving into this next part. What are you aiming for? And it's one of those things about a courtship that I don't think we always realize that we're actually building a foundation under our marriage during our courtship time. So how we do our courtship actually does lay a foundation for what the marriage will be like. Now, on the other hand, even as I say, you lay a foundation, you kind of dig your basement so you can put something solid on it. Some of us have laid a good foundation in our courtship time, and then we go and live in a tent. We don't build on the foundation. So it's important that we in our courtship, we lay a good foundation, and then we continue to build on it. That's why we like to say marriage is an ongoing courtship. You never stop courting each other. And I had an illustration of that last night. We were at a birthday party, and there was one of the wives having gone for 4 weeks to Hong Kong for a job assignment. She does this every year. And so we were saying, well, how was it? You know, how is it to be back? And she kept saying how nice it was to be with her children and how she loved being with her children again and how she had missed them. And her husband was sitting next door, right next to her, and I was thinking, like, I wonder how he feels not to even be mentioned, you know, like, was he missed? You know, does she like being back with him? Or maybe she hasn't even had a chance to think of it. I don't know. But you see that sense of keeping the marriage as the priority. Children will take 24/7 of your time, and your spouse will put up with it, you know, and we have to keep that courtship at the forefront. So that's why we talk about what are you aiming for. And as we've studied the next verses, the only way we can make sense of them, because they're like they're these pictures, is to say, oh, this must be something about how the way they have courted. And so what we see are four pictures in these next verses, 1:9 to 2:7. So I'm going to take you picture by picture. So there's four. So the first one, I'll just say, it seems to be that they're in the palace. That's the only way you can see, because they're talking about Pharaoh's horses. And so thinking, like, well, where would that be? And we imagine them like on a balcony. Do you remember Princess Di wedding? Is anybody old enough to remember Princess Di wedding and how they're standing on that balcony looking out all over the crowds of people? Well, I sort of imagine that with them looking out over the court and what's there. So Solomon is speaking to her, and he says, I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. And then we think it's the daughters of Jerusalem who say, we will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. So it's one of those pictures, like if Hank had said to me, you know, I liken you, my darling, to a mare, I'd say, huh, are you comparing me to a horse? But you see, in that culture, a horse is such a beautiful thing. And having been raised on a farm, we had dairy cows, and all I wanted was a horse. You know, and my dad would say, but a horse, what does it do? You know, it doesn't, cow produces milk. So I sat on a cow long enough that my dad finally consented to give me a horse. I can remember cars going by laughing, this girl sitting on a cow. But anyway, a horse is a beautiful thing. And having been raised in California, we have this Tournament of Roses parade on January 1st. And the horses in that parade are absolutely gorgeous. They have silver bridles on them. They have the manes are woven, like plaited together with ribbons. The whole saddle, and they will describe these saddles, how many, you know, pounds of gold, I forget how they do it exactly, but or gold or silver is on this saddle, and it goes all the way over the back of the horse. It's incredibly beautiful. And then, of course, the tail as well is all plaited with ribbons in it. The horse looks absolutely gorgeous, and then it walks with such grace. You know, it prances. It's such a beautiful creature to see, and has such a beautiful shape. So for Solomon, who loved animals and loved horses, they say David did not. David liked donkeys, and Solomon liked horses. I could go back into that, but we won't. And so here, for him to say, you look like a Mary, it's like, oh, you're beautiful. And in the Pharaoh's chariot, what they would have is like your wealth was measured by how many horses did you have pulling your chariot. Some of you will remember Ben-Hur. You know, this long string, pairs of horses. But the very front one was the favorite. And in this case, it was the mare. This beautiful creature, sensitive creature, that would lead the whole stream, the very favorite one. And so he says, I liken you to a mare. Your cheeks are beautiful, just the way that horse has been decorated. So your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. And it's like the court women seem to join in and say, we affirm that. She's beautiful. We know she's from the country, but we know what to do with this girl to make her even more beautiful than she is today. So what are we saying about courtship? We're saying that, you know, that appearance is part of the courtship. You remember those days, girls, right? How much time did you spend? Let's see, shall I wear this dress or this dress? You know, how shall I do my hair? And hopefully not all of you were like that, but some of us were quite vain at that point of our relationship and very concerned. But you see, the appearance is part of what has happened in our relationship. There's been some sort of an attraction between us. And somehow, often when we get married, we forget about that. You know, the guys start running around in their sweats everywhere, and the girls forget to dress up. Oh, I'll put the makeup on when I go out, and they don't look beautiful for him anymore. We forget about the fact that that was the person that they met. You know, why would we start to neglect that side of the relationship? You see, God seems to say the physical is part of the relationship. And we won't even talk about weight, because that's a tough one, because I've struggled with that myself. So if there is something to be said about appearance and about affirming each other. So when Hank says, oh, you look so pretty in that dress, that's a very kind thing for him to say. He could say, oh, yeah, I've seen that dress 20 times. You know, you still look pretty in it. But he takes the time to say, oh, you look really pretty in that. Or, you know, some part of my body says, oh, I like that, you know. And it's, oh, well, okay, you know, it still looked nice. So we just need to hear that from each other. And it feeds the marriage. Remember, so we were talking about sex. Eat, oh, friends, drink, oh, lovers. How that sex nourishes the marriage. But affirmation also nourishes the marriage. And then we get into the next picture. It says, while the king was at his table. So there's this sense of this isn't a big formal banquet, but they have to eat. So they're sitting together at the table, and she says, my perfume spreads its fragrance. My lover is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts. My lover is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi. And you see, in those days, because of the heat, you had to be able to, you didn't have deodorants the way we do today. So you would have a string around your neck, and you'd have a sachet, and in that would be a perfumed oil that was mixed with wax. And so when you put it on, you would close up the piece of cloth with this oil in it, and then you would tie it around your neck. And so in the morning it would be cold, but as the day got warmer and you started to perspire, it would start to melt, and it was right here where you catch a lot of heat. So as she would get warmer during the day, then the perfume would start to melt just when she needed it. But what is she saying? She's saying, he is to me like something precious. There's this, again, this fragrance. Your name is like a perfume poured out. You are a fragrant thing to me. But there's this sense of excitement. I'm here. I can't believe I'm in Jerusalem sitting across from the king. My memory, which is only a little bit like this, is when I met Hank. I met him at a church retreat, a youth retreat, and he was the speaker and I was a counselor, and I had my little, you know, group of high school students I was looking after. And so then after that, it's a fun story, but I won't tell you now, but he came to date, you know, he came on a date. And we went to church and we did a little thing afterwards, and he brought me home, and at some point he kissed me. And my first thought was, I've just been kissed by a minister. So like, it's like, oh my goodness, you know. But this is, you know, it's like, oh, I'm sitting across from the king, you know, I got kissed a minister. <It's> like, so I kind of got past the minister thing in time. But so there's this lovely excitement about this, just having a meal together. You know, do you take time just to have a meal together? You know, say, okay, kids, we're feeding you early. Dad and I are just having a meal together tonight. Do you take that time? Eating is such an important thing because as our bodies relax and are nourished, so we can just begin to share what's going on in our hearts in a very, very casual way. I believe very strongly in the importance of mealtimes. And then he responds and he says, how beautiful you are, my darling. And they're beginning now to take a walk. You'll see as the verses go down. And they're a little controversial. What do they mean? We think we know. We have a sense of what they mean. But verses 15-23, he says, oh, how beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. So this is the first time. She's going to hear this again on the wedding night. But isn't it? He's saying, you know, I just love looking into these peaceful, gentle eyes, serene eyes. And she responds. There's a give and take of affirmation. How handsome you are, my lover. And how charming. And then she says, our bed is verdant. Now that word bed in Hebrew is a sense of a couch rather than what we would think as a place to sleep. And it's like they're outside. It's like we picture them walking in the countryside. And she's saying, you know, here our couch, we can just sit here in the countryside and enjoy the time together. The beams of our house are like cedars. Our rafters are fir. And then it's almost like she begins to feel overwhelmed. She says, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Now, those of us who have seen Rose of Sharon in our climate, it's a large bush. The one I remember is a large bush with big pink flowers. But in Israel, the Rose of Sharon is a tiny pink flower, and it's scattered over the meadow. There's a million of those. And the same with the Lily of Valleys. There's thousands and thousands of Lilies of Valley. So what is she saying? I feel so insignificant. Here I'm with the king, but who am I? I'm just a girl from the country. That's all I am. So she says, I'm a Rose of Sharon, a Lily of the Valleys. And he, wise man, he's learning his skills. He assures her and he says, you are like a lily among thorns, is my darling among the maidens. So he knows how to affirm her. When she's feeling that sense of insignificance, inferiority, he says, hey, do you know who you are to me? You are a lily among thorns. So there's that beautiful sense of assurance that he returns to her. And then she responds and she says, you are like an apple tree among the trees of the forest. Now, what we don't know is that an apple tree was considered the sweetheart tree of all the trees. You know, so she's saying, oh, you see all those trees in the forest? You're the apple tree. You're my sweetheart. If I'm your lily among thorns, you're my apple tree. It's beautiful, isn't it, when you understand what she's saying and what they're saying. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. And we'll find the apple tree again at the end of the song. And then we move into the last one, which is it's like you feel like their relationship is progressing. They're learning to communicate. She's able to communicate her misgivings and her fears. And then they come into the banquet hall, 2:4 to 2:7. He has taken me to the banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. And then I'll carry on with that. But now you see, what is the banquet hall? This is where everybody is gathered. It's a significant point in a relationship when he starts introducing you to all his friends, and he invites you for Thanksgiving dinner or for Christmas dinner at his house. You know that it's saying something. It's a significant time. And it's like we call it a public acclaim, the word acclaim. He is saying, I want you all to know, this is the one. This is the one I want you to know. She's the one I intend to marry. And it says, his banner over me is love. I thought a lot about that picture, the banner over me. And of course, you know, in battle, the banner was over the king, right? And recently, about a year or so ago, we were in Ottawa, and it just caught a glimpse of Parliament with the flag, you know, the Canadian flag, and it was just such a powerful picture of here is, the, you know, the center of our country is represented in that flag over the Parliament. And I think what I love is that the banner over her is does not say Solomon, you know, it's not, she doesn't, it's, he's not saying she belongs to me. It's not, the banner isn't Solomon, the banner is love. It's like, this is the one I love. And there, to me, there's such a sense of freedom and affirmation that he gives her in saying, her she says his banner over me is love. It's not ownership, it's love. Love is the is what identifies her with him. And this has a powerful effect. I think when the guy starts saying, this is the one I want to marry, everything in the girl's heart begins to get excited, think, this is the guy I'm going to marry. And there's this great sense of anticipation that you catch, and she's kind of overwhelmed with it. And she says, strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. The sense that we have of that is the arousal. It's like, I can't wait. This is going to be so good to be married to this guy, to actually be embraced, to be physically embraced by this guy. And she begins to get very excited about what that will be like, her imagination. But then it's like she catches herself right away and she says, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. You see, she has the feelings that come with being in love, the physical, sexual feelings that come with being in love. But she's saying, yeah, the guy is right, but the time isn't right. So friends, I call on you. Help me to wait until the right time. So there's the sense of the courtship, is that spending time together, doing things together, that makes for a good relationship, and you continue to do it after you get married. There's one little picture I wanted to draw that helps, I think. It's by a lady called Satir. She says a marriage is like a jar or a bank account. And we have a choice to either put into it or take out of it. And you're saying, well, how do we do that? Well, what this couple has done, is there are two things. You put time in, and you put words in. Those are the two things that she says you put into a relationship to make it strong. So if you're putting in time with each other, that you're saving time for each other, even though you're busy with all those kids and all the things you have to do, you're prioritizing time in your relationship, you're giving those words of affirmation. There are wonderful things that happen, and she lists a number of things, but you feel valued. If someone wants to spend time with you, you feel valued. You feel appreciated. There's a contentment that grows in you. There's a motivation in life. You know what we're talking about? The marriage feeds into the rest of your life. There's a sense of general happiness as well as sexual contentment. Like that happens when you put the time and the words in. But what about if the words are negative? What if you're not spending time? Well, it's exactly the opposite, as you can imagine. The person begins to feel not valued. This happens to wives. It happens to husbands. You feel not valued or not taken for granted or not appreciated. And there's a discontent that sits underneath you, and your motivation begins to dissipate, and there's a sense of unhappiness and often sexual unfulfillment as well. So just this is so important, this time of making your relationship a priority and having that ongoing courtship. So that's it. What are you aiming for?
All right, our last section of last part of the first main section on courtship. And hopefully we'll leave enough time for you to chat some around the tables at the end of this and before lunch. Kathy mentioned Prince Charles and Princess Diana. The investigation in her death is even 10 years plus later is still ongoing. But an interesting little story about their wedding is that when they stood on the balcony of Buckingham Palace, it was reported that at one stage of both dressed in full wedding regalia, right? They were really dressed up nicely, her wedding gown and all the rest, and waving to the crowds. And he whispered to her and said, "Shall we kiss? This is okay for two people to do at their wedding, but not for two royalty." It had never been done publicly. But he said, "Hey, on the spur of the moment, shall we kiss?" And she looked back at him and said, "Why ever not? Shall we kiss? Why ever not?" They whispered to each other. How do we know what these two said to each other at that intimate moment? Well, the Times of London had hired lip readers with binoculars to catch everything that was going on that balcony. So, the interesting thing is, Diana struggled this for her entire lifetime, and so does the church, how to privately belong to Charles and how to publicly belong to the empire. How do you manage that? Diana, in the end, couldn't. Our girl here struggles with it, and the church struggles occasionally as well. How do you belong to my Savior of my soul and to the Lord of the universe at the same time? So, interesting little picture on the balcony there, some 20 or so years ago, whatever it was. Okay, let's read the next section, 2:8 to 3:5. 2:8 to 3:5. "Listen, my lover, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. My lover spoke and said to me, 'Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. See, the winter is past, the rains are over and gone, flowers appear in the earth, the season of singing has come, the cooing of doves is heard in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit, the blossoming vines spread their fragrance. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. My dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the hiding places on the mountainside, show me your face, let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom. My lover is mine and I am his. He browses among the lilies until the day breaks and the shadows flee. Turn, my lover, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the rugged hills. All night long in my bed," she says, "I looked for the one my heart loves." It's probably a dream sequence. "I looked for him but did not find him. I will get up now and go about the city, through its streets and squares. I will search for the one my heart loves. So I looked for him but did not find him. The watchmen found me as they made the rounds in the city. 'Have you seen the one my heart loves?' Scarcely had I passed them when I found the one my heart loves. I held him and I would not let him go till I had brought him to my mother's house, to the room of the one who conceived me. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires," are the last words before the wedding scene gets underway. So what are we waiting for? Obviously, he's the right one for her. She's the right one for him. What are we waiting for? And we've divided that section into three parts. 2:8 to 14 is welcoming the doves. 2:8 to 14 is welcoming the doves. And then watching out for the foxes, 2:15 to 17. And then winning over the butterflies is 3:1 to 5. Okay? So I love alliteration. It appeals to some people. It really annoys others. But I hope you like alliteration. But it's welcoming the doves and watching out for the foxes and winning out over the butterflies. The first scene then, 2:8. Listen, listen, my lover. Listen, my lover, look, here he comes, He stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. This scene clearly takes place in her home country of Lebanon. And what I really appreciate so very much about the Song of Solomon, among other things, is that there are two extended periods when he goes away and spends with travel to and from at least a week or more. It takes 2-3 days to get up, 2-3 days to get back again. Who knows how long there? We don't know. But at least a week before the wedding, 2:8-14, and there's another week after the wedding in 7:4-8:4. So there's two sections, one pre-wedding, one post-wedding, that he takes out, and that's important, pre-wedding and post-wedding, he's still courting, that he takes out a significant amount of time to spend time with her in her familiar terrain. Now there's vineyards and her family, her childhood friends, who are no doubt awestruck by the fact that she's brought home a king. Not only a boyfriend, she's brought home a king. So you can imagine nonstop conversation in that part of Lebanon. And the whole Mount Hermon is kind of ringing with the conversations. Guess who she's brought home again? So there's two sections where they spend intensive time together. And what at least it says to me is that if Solomon, with an empire to run, and probably 3 hours first thing in the morning he's catching up on his email, no, the in-tray is overflowing. The cell phone is even more of a nuisance than it is to you and I. No, everybody wants time with a king. Everybody has an agenda with a king. Then everyone who comes through the door, Solomon says, oh, great to see him. No, he says, what does he want? No, what do they want? That's why Richard Nixon had a shady character as a close friend, because he said, here's a guy who doesn't want anything from me. He's just my friend. He doesn't want anything from me. So Solomon had this 24-7, nonstop, and yet with his schedule, and here's the point, that is busier than any one of you in this room, and anyone in Rosemont Bible Church, than any Christian in Montreal or La Belle-Provence or in Canada. He's the busiest man that you could put forth in the 10th century BC or any century, and yet he has time to take out a week for his fiancée, and he has time to spend a week with his wife. So when I see this passage and what's happening here, and a man, usually it's a man, not a woman, but a man tells me, I can't fit in that sort of time for my marriage. I don't have that sort of time for my wife. I'm just too busy. Well, busy is a four-letter word, and it just doesn't cut it. It just does not cut it. It really doesn't. Leslie Parrott, their marriage counselors in Seattle, they've put out a wonderful little book called The Love List. Lousy title, great book, The Love List. And part of what they say we've already followed for years, you know, thanking the Lord, is that we try to take out some time each day, you know, to say, I'm still glad I married you. And it's not bad for you to call from where you work, to call him where he works, and say, you know, I just saw all the young men at work and all dressed up and their best toothpaste and best smile. And then I thought about you, and I thought, boy, I'm so glad I chose you. Now, all these guys around the office don't hold a candle to you. I'm glad I married you. Now, that can make a difference what happens after they get home from work, right? So just a call, 10 seconds investment in the marriage, or I was just thinking about you. You know, that goodbye kiss this morning, could we try that again tonight? It doesn't take 5-10 seconds, something every day, and then a date every week. Somebody put this in our in-tray, and we followed it for most of 10 years in Africa, is that every week Kathy and I had a date. We'd go out somewhere. Lusaka, Zambia had 500,000 people at the time, 500,000, three restaurants that would ensure our survival, and one, the Il Bambino, great little restaurant. We went there, candlelight and tablecloths, not made out of plastic. This was a nice, nice little place. And we agreed that from the moment our key hit the ignition to when we were home again, 2-3 hours, 3.5 hours later, we agreed we would not say one word about the children. We would not say one word about the children. We pretended they did not exist. And we talked about ourselves, dreams, our work and how it was affecting us. But the common topic, what are we going to do about Johnny? And how do you read the changes that Susie's going through? Well, wow, you're at it for the next hour, right? You've talked about them. You've not talked about you. So if the marriage is supposed to outlast the family, we invested in the marriage one date every single week for years. And something else that we've really enjoyed, we still do it in Quebec. We do it every year, once for sure, without exception, sometimes twice. We spend a weekend away. And we mix it with places that we know and places we don't know. We had a little place in Île-aux-Coudres, just south of Baie St. Paul, that we have been every fall for 4 years now. We spent four or five days there, Île-aux-Coudres. And it's a wonderful little place, all French. We're total imposters. But we come to know some people there. We favorite places to eat, a little internet cafe. Île-aux-Coudres, we love the place every fall. And then we'll explore new places, but it's marital time. That's the kind of time that Solomon took very seriously, a week now and another week after the I do's were said. So daily, weekly, annually, how are you investing in the only marriage that is supposed to end by death, until death do us part, and God does not see you crossing your fingers when you say that. I hope, no, until death do us part. The only thing that stops a good marriage is a coffin. Okay? So here he is investing already. Listen, my lover. Look, here he comes. Impossible schedule and all. Here he comes. He's coming. I am more important than the empire. And she is. Somehow, she is. Empires come and go. But this wife will be with him until he dies. Listen, my lover. Look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills, mountains of Israel, the hills of Lebanon. My lover's like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. He's, when you get a hold of this, he's like a kid again. He's really a kid again. Like he gets on his Harley, and he's 10 or 20 miles per hour over the speed limit. He's racing to get up there. He can't wait to see her. All the images of their last time flow through his mind, the time they first held hands, the delicious taste of the first kiss, looking at her, even more beautiful than I remember. All of that goes through his head. And then when he finally gets there, he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. He suddenly gets cold feet. And he's probably wondering, what if I open the door and it's her mother? You know, what do I do? Does she still feel the same way about me? So he races up there, and then he dawdles, and he pokes underneath the Harley to see if something needs to be fixed, and he knows, well, nothing needs fixing. But he's just puttering around because that final ounce of courage is just not there. But finally he comes, and she picks up the conversation. My lover spoke and said to me, "Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me." See, and there's seven pictures how springtime takes the place of winter, also in their relationship. Seven pictures of springtime. See, the winter has passed, the rains are over and gone, flowers appear, season of singing has come, the cooing of doves, the fig tree. It's followed by seven invitations. There's seven pictures of springtime, the springtime of a relationship that follows the grays and the loneliness of the singleness of winter, right? And seven invitations follow. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. And then that wonderful verse 14, what is he asking? My dove in the clefts of the rock. My dove in the clefts of the rock and the hiding places on the mountainside. There's a lot of things that I do not yet know about you. There's a world to discover. This whole thing about being a student of your wife, of your husband, a student of your partner, going asking questions more about their past and how they react to certain books or movies or how they react to certain other people and what they've said and what they've done. Just endlessly exploring, why does she act, why does he react in that way? And to wonder and to ask why and to explore. Change your statements into questions. Now, there's more to this girl. She's still hiding in the clefts. She's still in the hiding place in the mountainside, and I've got to flesh her out. And I've got to get to know this woman. And critically important, how do I get to know her? How do I develop and grow this relationship? Well, show me your face so you grow a relationship in the daylight, not after dark. And let me hear your voice. It grows by using your vocal cords, not your hands. For your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Now in verse 2:14, I think Phil works Friday nights with young people here at Rosemont. Maybe some of the others do as well. 2:14 is a world of wisdom distilled into one verse for young people who are very keen to be attached to somebody or to be connected to somebody. I am going with, and you don't want empty space at the end of that sentence. It's so important to be going with somebody, and then to be continuing to go with somebody and to nail him and make him commit. Often you do so after dark using hands and other body parts. The Song of Solomon says the only safe way, the recommended way to develop a relationship is in the daylight using your voices. It's a world of wisdom in just one verse. Daylight, using your voice. Explore with a voice where you can see the eyes. We had ongoing conversations with our girls. We have three girls. They all went through their teenage years, and we had ongoing discussions about curfew and the kind of music, the volume of the music. But we would ask them, they say, well, everybody else is coming in at 1, and we had suggested 11, which we thought was reasonable. So we negotiate 1 a.m. or 11 p.m. And then our bottom line was, tell us some good things that happen after midnight. And usually they had a hard time coming up with anything good that happens after midnight. And we'd agree on midnight, and if anything goes wrong, you're the last one to be dropped off after the activity. So it's 12:15, 12:30, we expect a phone call. And they were good enough kids, thank God, that with one exception, they always called if they were going to be late. But it's, again, this after midnight stuff that when it goes later and later, it gets darker and darker, and the voices run out of things to say, especially male voices, and you begin to communicate with other body parts, and bad things happen. And you give away your body long before your heart is ready. Isn't that true? So here's the antidote right here. Let me hear your voice for your voice. Let me see, show me your face. Let me hear your voice for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. And again, the men among us need more help in this area than the women. Gary Smalley has done the homework. And he has discovered, many others have concurred with this, that the average man speaks about 10,000 words a day. The average woman speaks about 20,000 words a day. And it's I heard that. It's 10,000, 20,000, it's about a 2-to-1 ratio. So I thought, isn't that interesting? If only he knew, if only she knew, Gary Smalley, good author. So I thought, well, let's count the words in Song of Solomon that he speaks and that she speaks. It's almost 2-to-1 that she speaks over what he speaks. It's almost 2-to-1, not quite. Almost 2-to-1, exactly as Gary Smalley. See, in the beginning of a marriage beginning to get unraveled and unglued is when he's at work spending his 10,000 at work with some colleagues and with upper-level management meetings and traveling. A colleague comes in from Winnipeg, and you have a long conversation with him. You have a power lunch together. And he gets home, and most of his 10,000 words are gone. But she has spent goo-goo, ga-ga, da-da, and all the rest with a six-month-old. And no, don't. Stay out of that. Don't touch. To her three-year-old. That's been the extent of her conversation. She's got about 20,000 words left. And she says, honey, how was your day? And expects a 5, 10-minute, 15-minute detailed response with the inflections and moods and all the rest. And he says, fine, what's for supper? And the relationship begins to unravel, you see. Because the conversational maps are not aligned at all. So conversation, learning to talk. Marriage Encounter has a wonderful little scheme. They call it the 10-10. Every day, find a place, find a time. We have two chairs, two bodies, two sets of eyes, two sets of hands. You hold each other's hands to minimize damage. So you hold each other's hands, hold each other's eyes, and the husband says, honey, tell me about your day. And he does not interrupt. He does not get to interrupt for 10 minutes. She may have trouble fitting it all into 10 minutes, but she has 10 minutes with no interruptions and no promise from the man who is very able and very willing to fix it, whatever is bothering her. He loves to fix stuff. But he lets it go on for 10 minutes without fixing anything. He's just listening. And then she says, and how was your day? And he struggles to fill his 10 minutes, but she does not interrupt. And that gift of 10-10 every day can be a lifeline for more marriage. Okay? So, catch for us the foxes. There's the second. Welcome the doves. Welcome the doves. Watch out for the foxes. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom, below our property where we lived in the interior of the Cariboo, British Columbia. A little fox colony adopted us. There was a mom and about six or seven kits, I think they call them, and they were just down the hill. Cute little guys would peek out now and then, and mom, they would go for a little stroll late afternoon, explore the neighborhood, and cute, we thought. Our neighbor said, well, as soon as you start growing stuff on the side of the hill, rhubarb, whatever you grow, you won't think they're cute anymore, because especially the little ones will get just underneath the ground level, and they'll start nibbling away at the roots of anything that is growing, anything that's attractive. They'll nibble away at the roots. You won't see what's happening. It'll appear to continue growing, but slowly on, green turns to brown. Because out of sight, underneath, the roots have been destroyed. Foxes have been nibbling at the roots. And relationships will turn from green to brown if you don't identify and then address the roots. One of the best conferences that I've ever been at, and it's one of the best in Livingston, Zambia, 2 years ago, is that it's one of those rare conferences that Kathy and I spoke once each. They gave us a morning, a 4-day, 5-day conference, something like that. They gave us a morning, so we talked very little. One of the reasons it's probably one of the neatest conferences ever, because our friend Geshem Chione, Friday night, he explained about the foxes. He talked about this passage, 2:15 to 17, foxes identified it, put it in its cultural setting, why young foxes destroying the vineyards, what is it about foxes and vineyards, are they into wine? He talked about all of this wonderfully on Friday night. And then he said, well, from here on, it's over to you. And for whatever it was, 28 couples that were there for the weekend, holiday weekend in Zambia, Heroes in Unity weekend, the couples got together and they identified the foxes they were struggling with in their marital friendships. And they came up with 26. 26 foxes. And one fox, they said, and they had to choose, now the next session, hour and a half, we're going to devote to this fox and see if we can chase it and kill it, so it doesn't do any more damage to the vines that God wants to grow with delicious wine for our relationship. How can we identify and then pursue this fox? And the first one they nailed, I wouldn't have guessed that. They said, what about Sunday morning? They said, Sunday morning is just a prime time, typical marriage, right? A prime time. The wife has put the breakfast on the table, usually a hot cup of tea and some mealy meal and so on, and has dressed the kids, for the younger kids, dressed the kids again, two or three tries. And all the while, the husband is all dressed up in his suit and tie, and he's valiantly and patiently leaning on the horn in the driveway, waiting for her to come out. And she's been taking care of the food and the kids and cleaning up a bit afterwards. And it's either very frozen or there's a bit of volume in the car on the way to church. And then they step out and say, ah, Brother Absalom, how good to see you again. And Hypocrisy 101 is underway. So they said, what about Sunday morning? And I was so tempted to say, because I'm a male, I fix things, right? I fix things. I said, folks, you fix Sunday morning on Saturday night. It's all about what you do on Saturday night. And the Holy Spirit said, he said it very nicely. He said, Hank, shut up. Just shut up. Just stay quiet. They'll come up with it. They really will. So I stay quiet, and in time, what about Saturday night? And they came up with all kinds of creative ideas on how to use Saturday night to make Sunday morning more manageable and even enjoyable. And we went through all kinds of foxes that weekend, and the couple